This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Dr. Scott Hardiman on the show. He's a physician at Gateway ENT, also at Urgent Specialist. Check out urgentspecialist.com. He joins us to talk about, in a nonpartisan way, the latest happenings with COVID. Dr. Hardiman, thank you so much for coming back. Hope you had a wonderful Thanksgiving.
Thank you. I did. I hope you did as well.
Yes, we did. It was different, but it was good.
different. That's right.
I think the first question that I have is, you know, we were all supposed to be very concerned about Thanksgiving gatherings for people who did get together. I would assume, are we Monday here? That would be if people gathered on Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, 4 days out from that gathering. If there was going to be a mini super spreader event at anybody's Thanksgiving dinner, how close are we now to starting to have those symptoms onset where people might begin to be concerned?
Well, you could start to see them this early, but I think probably a few more days or so. I think the trajectory on that will probably peak around 5 to 7 days after, a gathering or an event. That's usually the time when if someone's going to convert positive, the vast majority of people do. It can be earlier, but generally around a week or so. So towards the middle of the week, and then, you know, if the case numbers don't dramatically spike, hopefully we'll see that the numbers of admissions to hospitals, et cetera, all the trickle down effect from that tends to be a little less significant as well. So time will tell. I guess anytime you have large gatherings, which the argument there is, did most people have large gatherings, or did most people try and, you know, have those tough decisions within their family of how to best handle their particular situations? And I think we'll know more over the course of the next 2 or 3 days here.
So, Dr. Hardiman, if people do start to feel something coming on, it's December, it's not unusual to get a cold, close to December, I should say, it's not unusual to get cold symptoms at this time of year. What are the symptoms that you want people to be alert to that should push them to go get that test?
So the symptoms are really all over the board now, and we have sort of passed through allergy season, generally any respiratory-related symptoms, but it continues to be symptoms that seem associated with headaches, generalized muscle fatigue, body aches, respiratory symptoms, congestion, loss of sense of taste and smell, fever, really any of those things. But, you know, it's been unique in that what we've seen recently is that symptoms run kind of a broad spectrum. You know, if we were to turn back the hands of time 2 or 3 months, I think our attitude generally across the area was, you know, there's just not a huge amount of community spread. The numbers are still relatively low in the grand scheme of things. So why don't you just wait a day or two and kind of see what the symptoms do? We're at a point now where, you know, we all know someone who's had this or, is going to be positive here in the not too distant future. And so I think if you have those symptoms that just seem new and different from what your norm would be, especially the ones that I just mentioned, it's certainly not unreasonable to be tested just to make sure. But the other thing you have to kind of remember is these tests are just not 100% bulletproof. And so even if you get a negative test, it's still pretty wise to just lay low for a few days and get a sense of what's going on with your body. If you rapidly improve, it's less likely that you had coronavirus. If you feel like you got worse, it's not unreasonable to get tested again because, again, these things are just not 100% accurate, which makes it tricky, obviously, for just people to kind of know. And the availability of testing around as well. It's just not that easy to just pop in and say, I want to get a test done. I mean, it's a finite capacity that we have, and people that are, you know, quite acutely ill or potentially being hospitalized, they're gobbling up a lot of test kits at this point.
Dr. Hardiman, I'm hearing very conflicting reports about hospitals and capacity right now, especially in our area. Do you have any reports about how we're doing either locally or nationally as far as hospital beds go?
Well, certainly locally, it's tricky. Two of the hospitals that I go to within the task force, numbers that are reported have around 100, slightly over 100 people that are coronavirus positive or under investigation. That's a pretty big number, but when you talk about a hospital that's 600 or 700 or 800 or 900 beds in capacity, obviously it's you're not filling hospitals with coronavirus patients. The number of people in the ICUs, are certainly they're holding steady, but they're kind of ticking up a little bit in the same those requiring ventilatory support. I think that's pretty universal. A lot of the other hospitals in the task force are not anywhere near those numbers. The tricky part is that the hospitals are the administration and the staff is there trying to sort of segregate out patients that have that are positive or under investigation so as to not expose people in the hospital for all these other routine things, which still the vast majority of folks admitted to the hospital right now are not coronavirus related. And so that makes it a little bit tricky just from a logistical perspective of how they set up the hospital, how you staff, and how you cover those things. So it's a fair number of people in the hospital for sure, no question, the highest numbers we've really seen. But, the capacity, I believe I read this morning, the capacity of ICUs for coronavirus patients are around 90% at this point, and overall capacity at the hospitals is in that sort of 85 to 87% range or so. But, people are getting sick with other issues as well, and it just logistically makes it tricky to kind of manage all that.
Dr. Hardiman is joining us right now. He's a physician at Gateway ENT, also with urgent specialists, and he talks to us each Monday about coronavirus from a medical standpoint. If you would have a question for Doctor, you can come onto the Facebook Live, facebook.com/AndyFryShow, or the Andy Fry YouTube channel. We're live there as well, and comment it. We've got questions coming in, and we ask those questions after the break that's coming up here. I want to ask you, Doctor, about what we know about the fatality rate, the death rate of COVID, comparing it to what we thought maybe at the beginning of this, initially in March and April, because I feel as though the emotion and the sentiment behind coronavirus is lagging behind the science, the progress, and the knowledge that we have at this point in time as to how damaging and I said earlier in the show, there's a lot of fear that is pushed out there about this virus. I think you can respect the virus without having to be afraid of it. But what do we know about that fatality right now, maybe comparatively speaking to the flu or other things that we are more familiar with that we didn't know at the beginning?
So early on, I think the numbers that were coming out of northern Italy and even out of China, for that matter, were really, really frightening, I think, for everyone. And it was just such an unknown entity. We hadn't really sorted out exactly, who was going to get it, how contagious it was, and what the comorbid issues or factors affecting that fatality rate were really going to be. I think early on there were even numbers in that 10% range or so out of out of northern Italy. Then as we kind of gathered more information, we saw that it was largely affecting nursing home population, older individuals, people with other health issues there. We started to get a sense that for the population, say 50 to 55 and lower, the mortality rate or fatality rate is incredibly low in that group of individuals, barring some complications or other issues that they might have. I think the official statement from the CDC right now still holds around 0.4% or so sort of overall mortality associated with this. But those numbers have kind of been called into question and a little bit lower. There's some Icelandic data. It's a small population, only a few 100,000 people in their country, but they've been very aggressive in how they've monitored this, which you can do with a small group of people in your society. And they're saying, which has been confirmed other places, it's in that sort of 0.3% range. Influenza, generally what's said, is around 0.1 to 0.15%, but we're not all over influenza like we are with this. We don't really know. It's a lot of projections and guessing and kind of going back and looking at admissions for pneumonias and other things in the hospitals at the end of a respiratory season and trying to sort out from there. So it certainly is lower, way lower than what was initially thought to be. And I think generally speaking, when the dust clears from this, I think this is probably going to end up being somewhere in the vicinity of influenza. But the tricky part with this is it's just so much more contagious, so it tends to run through the community a little bit easier. It's a little harder to track and keep our hands on it.
Doctor, here's the first question I have here from Don on Facebook. I heard the vaccine makes you sick. What side effects have been reported, and how long do symptoms last? What can you tell us about those side effects of these vaccines?
Yeah, the two that are probably furthest down the path, the ones that Secretary Azar just mentioned, Moderna and Pfizer, is those mRNA vaccines that we're hearing a lot about. The majority of the side effects seem to be local and regional to the site of injection, although back pain, muscle aches, and fatigue are things associated with it too. It did seem like some of those side effects seemed to be a little bit worse with the second dose that was given. And I think that's part of the issue that the FDA is going to have to really look at. I mean, most side effects related to this has been such a short process. We really only know over about a 3 to 4 month period of time as we followed those folks, because I think the phase 3 trials started sometime in August. So it seems to be that none of them were significant enough that they had to halt the trial, which was great. Long-term side effects or issues with those only really manifest over a period of time, but they can make some predictions and projections based upon the data that was seen from their initial safety studies, and of course those during the phase 3 trial as well. So a bit of a long answer, but I think most of the stuff seems to be related to localized injection site issues, and as well as some relatively mild systemic symptoms with those particular vaccines. As far as AstraZeneca, which is the next one that's out there, that's kind of in the process and released their data last week, that seemed to be a little bit less, and it seemed like majority of their side effects were just, again, sort of local regional injection site issues, much like when you get tetanus shots or influenza vaccines, where it tends to cause some swelling and muscle irritation right at the site.
Doctor, are there people who are being encouraged to maybe pass on the vaccine, maybe because their age, they're old or young or comorbidity or pregnant women? Is there anybody who's not supposed to get it?
Not at this point. It's a little bit unclear how this is going to be rolled out. Some of that is logistically just related to those two mRNA vaccines, that they're just tricky to manage. And I think both companies are struggling with that because they have to be stored at such an incredibly cold temperature, and how you do that and have them, you know, be used for vaccination within a 24-hour period of time with that, which is what my understanding is how that has to be done. So at this point, I think the general thought is to vaccinate those most vulnerable in nursing homes, those with comorbid issues, and then healthcare workers, of course, that are kind of on the front lines managing this, because as our doctors and nursing colleagues have a tendency to drop out, even if they have relatively mild illnesses, they're removed from the workforce, and that just puts more strain on the system. So I think that's generally the direction it will go.
Okay. Question for Dr. Hardiman from Vicky on Facebook. If you've had COVID, should you still get the vaccine? And if so, which one would you recommend?
That's a great question. I've asked that of a bunch of my colleagues recently. And again, I don't know that we have a real clear-cut answer. I think there's some question marks about the long-term immunity of having had coronavirus in the past. Again, to go back to the Icelandic study, they've been showing antibodies as much as 6 months out from folks that have suffered with the illness itself. I think probably much like with influenza and or booster vaccines, my guess is that they're going to suggest, once it reaches general population for distribution, that everyone gets it, and then there'll be probably some versions of the vaccine over a period of time that will function almost like boosters, just to kind of boost or stimulate your immune system every so often as we get a little more information about how long-term these antibodies tend to stick around our system.
Question from Matthew on Facebook. We hear a lot about not knowing long-term damage that COVID-19 mm-hmm. could cause, reduced lung capacity, et cetera. Are there any concerns about long-term negative consequences from the vaccine?
Well, that's a great question as well. And I think we have to rely mostly on the safety information from the initial phase 1 and phase 2 studies that are out there. The vaccines largely work to create either exposure of the spike protein or the antigens that are on the surface of the virus for our innate immune system to recognize that and develop antibodies to that, and then for future for the same thing, versus the mRNA vaccines, which use a genetic code to stimulate our own body to create spike protein. And then, again, the second part of the immune system sort of recognizes that and develops neutralizing antibodies to it as well. The mRNA vaccines, I think there's a tremendous amount of study that's been done on those over the years, but these will be the first of those. And I think long-term, we'll know more over time. The AstraZeneca or the protein-based vaccines are viral vector vaccines, where they use another type of virus and then attach an inactive protein to the surface and give those. That's more consistent with what we've seen with vaccines in the past. And I think over time, that certainly has been shown to be safe overall.
Dr. Scott Hardiman is on the phone with us. He's a physician at Gateway ENT and urgent specialist. And if you want to ask questions, you can ask those on our Eddie Fry Show Facebook or YouTube pages. Don is asking on the YouTube page, since the vaccine is only going to last a year, how do we learn to live with COVID? Do we get a vaccine every year for it?
Well, I'm not 100% certain the vaccine immunity is only going to last a year, and I don't think anyone knows that 100%, but it's a possibility. I think probably much like influenza, there may be some mutations in this that we have to make some slight alterations to the vaccine. Time will tell. This has really been a rapid process at this point to get to where we are, like they said earlier on your intro, about 10 months or so from start to finish at this point. So the immune system's pretty clever at recognizing these viruses, and even if they overall, if there's a mutation, the overall immunity or antibody levels were to drop, you know, it can recognize an exposure to a virus again. So it may not be the exact version, maybe a slight mutation, but that you still get some protection from that, just like we get from having one version of a common cold going to another. Some tend to be worse than others in just how they work. So my guess, again, is that we're probably going to go through this initial wave of vaccinations. We're going to slow the transmission. We're going to hopefully see, you know, things open back up again and the transmission rate drop tremendously. And then we'll start to sort out on an annual basis how often a vaccine is necessary to be done. They're likely going to do further studies to see just circulating neutralizing antibodies in folks that have had the vaccine, just how far out they go. Again, right now we're only, even those early people who had the vaccine from early August, are only 3 or 4 months into it at this time to really know how long those neutralizing antibodies tend to last.
Joe here on Facebook says, two questions for Dr. Hardiman. Daughter got a PCR test. They said to expect results in 24 hours. Okay, got the results in 5 hours. Did they cut corners? And the second question is, can the COVID PCR test mistakenly pick up other coronaviruses? So if you get your results back, is that 24 hours, how long it takes to process it? Or is that just how long they need to get through tests? Maybe you just get yours earlier.
Yeah, the machines that run these, and there are numerous machines that run these tests, a true PCR test that's run on a high-capacity machine, that's likely, if they told you 24 hours, it's likely more just a logistical issue. So they go into a machine, they run through the process, it's incredibly automated at that point, and they come out and they're red on the other side. So it was likely just an issue of timing of when, you know, when that sample went in and how it was done. So I wouldn't say that there's any issues with cutting corners on that. That type of PCR kind of is fairly automated. What was the second question again?
if the test, the PCR test, can pick up other coronaviruses.
Oh, so they're very, very, very specific to this particular issue because it's looking at the genetic makeup of it completely. The other side of that question generally is usually, can they miss something there? And the answer is they can. I think there's tremendous numbers of variables. They're not 100% accurate. No test is 100% accurate. You know, there's a sampling error of how the swab is done or where the source of the sample is taken from. And then just the machines themselves and how the test is actually run or where you are in the disease process and were they able to pick up enough virus. And then, of course, how many cycles of amplification, because that's effectively what they're doing, is getting samples of the viral RNA and then they're cycling it, amplifying it multiple times to try and recognize those snippets of the genetic makeup to do that. So they are very, very specific to this particular virus. As far as the sensitivity goes, you know, there are some false negatives that can happen with almost any of these tests.
Since the COVID-19 is a respiratory virus, I think the answer to this question will be obvious, but I'm going to ask it just to be safe. Sam from Facebook says, I cut my hand while out shopping. Can you get COVID-19 through an open cut?
To my knowledge, I know of no capacity to do that. It really attaches through this what's called the ACE2 receptor. That's a respiratory respiratory tree receptor, and it's not a bloodborne pathogen. It's respiratory related, so you're absolutely right.
William says, how many positive COVID results? So the numbers that we see in the news that we hear from the politicians, how many positive COVID results are from actual positive tests versus positive by association?
If I understand that correctly, I think the data that's being reported is really just based upon the state labs or participating labs and just the number of PCR tests that are done. Some states are accepting antigen tests. For a while there, they were accepting antibody tests as well, but I think largely these are just off of confirmed positive cases, not through contact association.
Okay.
Any possibility, says Mars on our YouTube page, any idea on the possibility to contract it twice?
So there's a handful of cases that have been reported. I think we probably haven't been at this quite long enough to know really what the level of mutation will be, and if you've had it once, if your antibody system and your immune system will protect you so that the cases tend to be very mild. I think there is some concern out there that that can happen, but still, in the vast majority and grand scheme of things, it should be a very low concern for most people. I think there's just a handful with less than 10 documented cases out there, to my knowledge, of a situation where someone has contracted twice.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance, too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Odyssey is giving you a chance to win a trip to London to see Taylor Swift at the Eras Tour. It's Tay in the UK.
Hey, it's Taylor.
Just download the free Odyssey app, log in and listen to a participating station for a minimum of 60 minutes to get your daily entry. And you could win a chance to fly off to London with three friends and see Taylor.
I can't wait to see you at the Eras Tour in London.
For more, go to odyssey.com/Taylor.
Tay in the UK.
It's on the Odyssey app. Thanks to Republic Records. This is a national contest.